Well, thank you, Dr. Jericho. My only other question was, is how many of those pictures were staged? But you can report on that offline. Our next speaker is Dr. Amber Bradshaw. And Dr. Bradshaw is a board-certified gynecologist practicing at Gynecology Specialists of Utah in Ogden. After graduating with her medical degree from the University of Utah School of Medicine, Dr. Bradshaw completed a residency program at the University of Utah Medical Center. She subsequently fulfilled a minimally invasive surgery fellowship at Florida Hospital Celebration Health, the Center for Specialized Gynecology and Global Robotics Institute. She specializes in laparoscopic and robotic surgery of benign gynecologic conditions, including hysterectomy, myomectomy, prolapse surgery, and tubal reversals. She was the first gynecologic surgeon in Utah to be fellowship trained in robotics. Unfortunately, I can't speak anything as far as her qualifications as a Frisbee player, but we welcome her this morning in any case.
Thank you so much. I just want to welcome or thank the Surgical Medical Society for having me here. It's such an honor to speak to you today about updates in gynecology, and hopefully we'll be able to shed some light on gynecologic topics today. Next, or do I have the slide? Did they give that to me? Is it this? Okay, so my disclosures is I am a speaker for Myriad Genetics, and I'm a proctor for Intuitive Surgical, and I hope that this works for the next. No, is this not the right clicker? AV problems. It happens to us all. So first we're going to talk about some updates in clinical gynecology. We're going to talk about cervical cancer screening guidelines and breast cancer screening guidelines and how those guidelines have changed over the last few years. Then we're going to switch to surgical updates and talk about hysterectomies in the US and how robotic surgery has played a role in that. And I don't, if someone could just tell me how to hit next, I will do it. But this is not working. And I have a lot of like next on my slide. You gotta go back. It's just not gonna work. I don't know. Do you have a clicker that works? Anything? Okay, great. So I need the next slide. Normally I just have my computer, I can go right through it. Not today. Next. Anybody? Bueller? Keep going. Uh-oh. It's just not my day today. That's perfect. We can do that one. So Pap smear guidelines have really changed drastically over the last 5 years. Okay. It works for you. And maybe I'll just have you come stand next to me. Have changed drastically over the last 5 years. The ACOG guidelines, which is the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, came out with new guidelines in 2012 and 2013. You're the magic touch. Cervical cancer has decreased by 50% over the last 30 years, and that is due to screening as well as Gardasil, which is the vaccine that prevents cervical cancer by protecting against the two most common types of HPV that we know cause cervical cancer. And there's two classes of HPV, the human papillomavirus. There's oncogenic, the cancer-causing, and that's mostly 16 and 18, and non-oncogenic, the types that don't. They either cause no effect or they can cause genital warts. And we know so much more about HPV than we did 5 years ago. We know that most women will clear HPV within an average of 8 months. In fact, 70% of women will clear their HPV within a year. So because of that, the screening guidelines state that pap smears should not begin before age 21. The old guidelines said that it should start 3 years after the onset of sexual activity. Well, they said, no, most of these young women are being overtreated. They're getting procedures when they shouldn't. And that was causing consequences like preterm labor and cervical incompetence in deliveries down the road. And so 21, no matter what, is the age that we start. In ages 21 through 29, they need a pap smear test alone. And that can be every 3 years. Gone are the days of every year, unless they've had abnormals. But if they're normal, every 3 years. From 30 to 65, they need co-testing, both with a pap smear and with HPV testing. They get both. No more of the pap smear reflexing to HPV. It's both together, and then they get that every 5 years. Women who have had a hysterectomy for benign reasons, and that means without a cancer or precancer, never need a pap smear again. The only exclusion to this is if they've had moderate dysplasia. And I'm sure you're thinking, well, how do I know if they've had moderate dysplasia? If they've had moderate dysplasia, they get a treatment on their cervix, and that's either a freezing or a LEAP procedure where we take off the bottom part of the cervix. If they've had one of those procedures, you can probably bet that they've had moderate or severe dysplasia, and they would need 20 years of pap smears after that procedure was done. You can stop pap smears at age 65, again, if they've had 20 years of normals after a moderate dysplasia, or if they've never had a history of dysplasia and they've had 10 years of normals, 65 is the age you get to stop. And they used to say, well, if they get a new partner restart, that's not in the new guidelines. It's 65 and done. So let's switch into breast cancer screening. And breast cancer is the second leading cause of death from women from cancer in women. 1 in 8 women will get breast cancer regardless of family history. Most is spontaneous, as you know. And this is hard to see. This is just the recommendations from many different societies about when to start. Most states start at age 40. The only outlier in that is the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force. This is the one time I don't like them that much. They say start at 50. I'm not a big fan of that. I don't know if you've also seen that women are getting breast cancer younger and younger, and there's probably a lot of environmental factors that play along with that, but I see it a lot in young women, so I'm not a big fan of 50. And then annually, except for, again, U.S. Preventative Service Task Forces, they say every other year. I'm not a big fan of that either. Gone or getting away from monthly breast examinations for patients. They did some studies on it. It wasn't very effective, but they say patients should have breast awareness. They should know what their normal breast tissue is, and if there's changes, they need to come see their provider. And I'm sure we've seen, primary care providers have seen patients that have had the normal mammogram and then they find their lump months later. I've seen that as well. What about high-risk patients? These are the people that get ignored, unfortunately. I don't know if people get scared of breast cancer history and they just don't want to embrace it, but it's so important. It makes such a huge difference in a patient's life. I saw someone in the office just this week who had 6 family members with breast cancer. No one had ever talked to her about her risk of breast cancer. They were doing mammograms on her every year, which is awesome, but nobody had ever talked to her about it, and she wanted that. She wanted to know what her risk was, and she wanted to know how she could prevent her breast cancer that she was so scared of getting. And so because the family history is important, it can lead us to start screening earlier. It can lead us to genetic test people for disorder or for genetic abnormalities like BRCA, which we'll talk about. And it'll lead us to do more screening depending on their risk assessment, and that's just a stratification of risk that we give them. So BRCA are genes that cause breast and ovarian cancer to run in families. There's 2 of them, there's BRCA1 and BRCA2. Genetic testing is available for people either with a personal or a family history of breast cancer and ovarian cancer. If a patient has one of these genes, they have an 87% risk of breast cancer. Can you imagine having an 87% risk of breast cancer? That's huge. If they have a gene, depending on which one, they have a 20 to 40% risk of ovarian cancer. Now, breast cancer we can screen for. Ovarian cancer we cannot. There is no screening. There is no way to prevent. We catch it late, and it is devastating. So if we can catch these people beforehand, they can be previvors. They can beat their cancer before they ever get it, rather than being survivors. And that's the goal. So let's look at recommendations from different societies. The U.S. Preventative Services Task Force has said primary care providers should be screening for these high-risk patients, and that's a grade B recommendation. Because they gave it a grade B recommendation under the Affordable Health Care Act, the BRCA tests will be covered if they meet their guidelines. So as a primary care provider screening for this, if you feel comfortable, a lot of primary care providers are testing for these genes, and if not, either referring them to a high-risk center or a genetics counselor to be tested. The problem there is a lot of patients don't follow up, so we're trying to get screening as much as possible in the office. ACOG, again, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, says evaluating for hereditary cancer syndromes, which is not just BRCA, there's a number of others, should be a routine part of an OBGYN practice. So who qualifies for testing? These guidelines I'm going to give you are NCCN guidelines. They're a little different from the Affordable Care Act guidelines. There's a couple of different ones out there. But NCCN, and this is just family history, state that a family member, any three family members, any age, qualify for testing. If you have a patient and she has four family members with breast cancer, it doesn't matter what age they were at, she qualifies. Two family members, if one of them was premenopausal, it's always hard to tell. Sometimes they don't know when menopause is. Average age of menopause is 51. So I have some that are much later than that, but if it was before the age of 51, you can probably guess they were premenopausal. One family member if they were less than 45. And then you can put, if the patient has a personal family or a personal history of this, you can add them in there. So if they had breast cancer at 30, they qualify for testing. If they had it at 51 and they were premenopausal and they have one other family member, they qualify for testing. Other other qualifications are ovarian cancer, any family member, any age, and they just need one. If they have more than one, red flags. Others are triple negative breast cancer. A lot of the BRCA1 patients get triple negative breast cancer, and so that's a big red flag. If they're not hormone receptor positive, that's an indication to be tested. And for sure, male breast cancer. I saw someone in the office 2 days ago. Her brother had breast cancer at 38, and she had two aunts that had it at 45. No one had ever tested anybody in the family, and nobody had ever talked to her about getting screened early. And she's 35 now. Brother had it 3 years from now. And obviously, she's very anxious and concerned about it. And we tested her. Obviously, it was 2 days ago. We're waiting on that. But a male breast cancer should get pushed through insurance for sure. Now, let's say you BRCA test, you send it off, or you send it to genetic counselor, they do it, it comes back negative. They are not now 1 in 8. They don't go to baseline risk of breast cancer. They're not 87%, but they're not 1 in 8 either. They're still high risk. And so what do we do with those patients? Or let's say you try to BRCA test them and insurance won't pay for it. It still happens, even though the U.S. Preventative Task Force says it's a grade B recommendation and most are paying for it. Well, there's a risk stratification that we can put them in. It's a simple questionnaire. I do it in my office. I have them fill it out. My MAs put it into a little database. It spits out their personal lifetime risk of breast cancer. If they're under 20%, they get mammograms just like everybody else, mammograms every year. If they're over 20%, then you add breast MRIs. They get their mammogram. 6 months later, they get their breast MRI, and then they alternate every 6 months. I haven't had any insurance companies not pay for a breast MRI when I've had this. I've had to make phone calls. They deny it, and then I call them, and then I say, this is NCCN guidelines, and I still have to do that, but I've never had anybody deny it. So let's switch gears and talk a little bit about surgical techniques and tools that are changing in gynecology. Hysterectomy is the second most common performed procedure by an OBGYN, and 60,000 are performed in the U.S. each year. By the age of 60, 1 in 3 women will have had a hysterectomy. 90% are performed for elective reasons, fibroids, bleeding, endometriosis, chronic pelvic pain. When you look at the evolution of hysterectomy, we started off with everybody getting opened. Everybody got a big incision. And then a lot of people transitioned to vaginal hysterectomy. And now you look at these new techniques of multi-port laparoscopy, single-site laparoscopy, and robotic laparoscopy. And the question always becomes, well, which is the best procedure? There's all these different types of hysterectomy. What's the best? There was a Cochrane review done with 34 different randomized controlled trials comparing the route of hysterectomy. They looked at vaginal, abdominal, and laparoscopic. Robotic was not really out at that time or really mainstream, and so they just looked at those three. They looked at over 4,000 patients. Their conclusions were that vaginal hysterectomy was the procedure of choice. But when vaginal hysterectomy was not possible, laparoscopic hysterectomy had many advantages over abdominal. There was faster return to activities. They went back to work sooner. There were fewer wound complications. There was a shorter hospital stay, and their blood loss was less. The downsides were that it took longer. In the studies, it took 20 minutes longer. And there were a few more urinary tract injuries, about 2.5 times more common. In 2009, ACOG, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, put out a position statement. They said that vaginal hysterectomy is the approach of choice whenever feasible, and that was based on good data that showed advantages, better efficacy, and lower complication rates. They stated laparoscopic surgery was an alternative to abdominal when vaginal couldn't be performed. The American Academy of Gynecologic Laparoscopists took that one step further in 2011 with their position statement. They still stated vaginal hysterectomy was probably the procedure of choice based on data, but they said that vaginal and laparoscopic should be mandated the procedures of choice, and that was based on many more studies that showed, again, they got back to work faster, their blood loss was less, their complications, especially wound complications, were less. And the exception of that is in some forms of cancer. Ovarian cancer, still gold standard, is a laparotomy. They also stated that surgeons who do not perform these procedures should seek the help of their colleagues or refer these patients. They shouldn't just open the patients if they didn't have the skill set. So really the goal when you look at these studies, when you look at these position statements, is to get away from a big incision. People can't afford to be out of work for 6 weeks. The complication rates are so high. Obesity in America is going up, and their wound complications and infection rates are huge. So when we look at that, you think, well, that, okay, no-brainer. Laparoscopic or vaginal hysterectomy should be first, and laparoscopic should be second, right? But when you look at rates, this is from 2005, 64% of hysterectomies were performed abdominally. 22% were vaginal, and 14% laparoscopic. Laparoscopic rates only increased by 11.5% over 10 years. Or more than 10 years, that was 13 years. Then a study in 2013, I think they put out this data from 2010. The abdominal hysterectomy rate only went down slightly, 53.6%. Vaginal did go down slightly, laparoscopic went up, and then robotics, which we're gonna talk about, started going up as well. And so what's the problem? Why can't we transition these patients to a procedure that's better for them? And this might be a little bit hard to see, but this is adoption rates for general surgeons and for GYN surgeons. The top blue, I don't know if the line's working, but the top blue you can see is cholecystectomy rates. And now pretty much almost 100% of cholecystectomies are being performed laparoscopic. The yellow line is bariatric surgery. And the learning curve there was a little bit steeper. It took longer, but now the majority of patients are being performed, majority of those procedures are being performed laparoscopically. The pink line is appendectomy rates. And even though they're not where they are in the others, that's probably due to ruptured appendices where they have to go in and open. They're still, the adoption rate is much faster. The purple line at the bottom is hysterectomy rates. And you can see that there's some increase, but really minimal, and we're still just barely above 20%. And so even though GYN surgeons did the first laparoscopic surgery, we are not very good at converting our surgeries to laparoscopic like our general surgeon colleagues. And this is probably due to a lot of different reasons. It can be the surgical field. Hysterectomies can be complicated. There can be distorted anatomy. The uteruses can be very large above the belly button. Things can be stuck together from certain diseases, either multiple laparotomies or endometriosis. Obesity. We all know obesity rates are going up, and it is hard to perform laparoscopic surgery in an obese patient. You're pushing through that fat tissue, and then the fat coats all the organs, which does make it more difficult. The instrumentation's a little bit limited. It's rigid and fixed, so you have to work around a pivot point rather than, we'll show you in laparoscopic surgery, it moves like the wrist. And then the learning curves are high, and that's well documented in GYN surgery, that the learning curves for a laparoscopic hysterectomy are between 75 to 100, depending on which study you look at. And when you look at that with surgeon experience, there's other studies that document surgeons that don't operate have more complications. And you think, well, that seems kind of straightforward. Why do we need a study to tell us that? People don't operate, they're gonna get more complications. But the data's out there, and when you look at people that don't operate a lot, and then you expect them to have a learning curve of 75 to 100 cases to adopt this, it's just not feasible for them in their practice. Then when you look at training, even when I trained, I had an 80-hour work week. Now it's 60-hour work week, and GYN surgeons are expected to be masters at open surgery, vaginal surgery, laparoscopic, and in some cases, robotic. And you keep them at a 60-hour work week, and it's only a 4-year residency, they're just not being trained appropriately in most cases. So let's look at how maybe robotic surgery can help with some of those obstacles and how it can have some benefit in cases. And when you look at robotic surgery, how it initially was funded, the research, was by the Department of Defense. And what they were looking at was, could we operate on soldiers in the battlefield but be remote from that? The surgeons be protected, even be in another country or a base far off, and operate on these people on the battlefield. The only FDA-approved robot now is the Da Vinci Surgical System. There were some progenitors that were around Zeus and other ones, but this is the one that's out now. And I just am showing some pictures of how it's advanced. This is the first generation. The second generation came out in 2006. It's smaller. The third generation, even smaller than that. And then the fourth generation, I'll show you in a minute. But in this picture, you can see there's three components to the robot. There's in the middle, there's the patient console, and that attaches to the patient. There's trocars that go through the abdomen. It attaches to those, and then the instruments go inside. The surgeon console, which is over here, the surgeon sits at that, and they operate the robot with hand controls and with foot pedals. And I'll show you a better picture of that in the next one. And then there's the vision cart, and that has the monitor, the camera, and some other instruments in it. The fourth generation Da Vinci system came out a month ago in April, and it's smaller. It has more capacity to work in both the lower pelvis and the upper pelvis while staying in the same position. It has better 3D vision, and the camera can go in any port rather than just the one port. It's still a big system, which we'll talk about in a little bit. There is some talk about maybe having one eventually come from the ceiling, so you take away that bulk, but I think we're a little bit far from that. So what are the benefits to robotic surgery? The benefit that I see is that the instruments move like the human wrist. They have 7 degrees of freedom. It's like my wrists are in the patient, but I get done with the surgery and they have little tiny holes. So do you need it for everything? No, but something very complex where I'm working in a very small space, for me, it provides a huge benefit to do that surgery. It does have high definition 3D vision. It filters tremor, so as surgeons get older, sometimes they have a little bit of tremor, it does filter that out. The surgeon can control all laparoscopic arms versus needing to rely on a bedside assistant, which may not be adequately trained. The intuitive controls are motion, or the motion controls are intuitive, and what I mean by that is when I move my hand right, the instrument goes right. When you move your hand right laparoscopically, the instrument goes left, and that's because it moves around a pivot point in that trocar. And so for a lot of people, especially if they didn't play video games, that can be a little bit harder to learn. Improved learning curves. Now, there's still a learning curve. It doesn't mean it takes the learning curve away. There's still documented learning curves for robotics, but it's not quite as steep as laparoscopic. And this is in GYN studies. And ergonomics, you get to sit rather than stand, which is a benefit to some, and more precise movement. This is just showing, again, that it moves like the human wrist. The cons, there's a loss of tactile feedback. I can't feel the actual tissue, and that can be a problem in some surgeries. Your vision does take over a lot of times, but that takes probably 100 cases for your vision to take over rather than feeling it. And sometimes I have to get radiologic procedures, especially like if I'm taking out a fibroid, I have to get an MRI. That way I'm not making multiple incisions on a uterus that needs to have a baby in there down the road. I make one incision, I know right from the radiology report where that fibroid is, and then I can go after it. It's bulky, which we talked about. It's a big system. It takes a lot of room. You have to have a big OR, and you have to move it in and out depending on which specialty is using it. Where I put it is different than where the urologist put it, is different where general surgeons put it, and is different than the cardiothoracic surgeons put it. The cost, the brand new system costs between $1.5 to $1.85 million. So it is a huge cost. Not only that, there's service costs that go along that you have to pay every year, and the instrumentation is expensive. So when some people ask, well, why don't people just go straight to robotics? Well, we really don't need to. If you have skills laparoscopically, there's no need to use the robot. This is for things that would be opened, advanced complex surgery that we're trying to prevent a big open incision with. Applications, how am I on time? Am I okay? Can I show some videos? Okay, we'll show a few videos if they work. I'm used to having my computer up here that I can work through them, so we're gonna see. Try video one. So video one, I was trying to show you guys the difference between straight stick and robotic surgery. So this is a straight stick, regular laparoscopic hysterectomy. I've taken out the uterus, and this is the top of the vagina. You can see there's a towel in the vagina holding the pneumoperitoneum. And what I want to demonstrate here is the instruments are fixed. You can see they're straight, they're not moving. I have to manipulate the tissue to put where I want so that I can put stitches in this. It's totally doable for this, but when I'm going to show you a video of a myomectomy where we're taking out a fibroid, you'll be able to see the much improved instrumentation, movement, and suturing that goes along with robotic surgery. We'll just throw this next stitch, and then we're going to show the next video after this. One second. Okay, perfect. And then if you will stop it and then show the second video. Sorry, and I don't have controls. I don't like to be out of control. Is that how most people are? They want to be in control of their things. And then see if, yeah, that'll, okay, so this is a robot. You can see I could never bend my instrument that way with a straight straight stick laparoscopic instruments. But I'm not suturing yet either. This is where I'd fast forward a little bit. I don't know if you can do that. Can you hit the, yeah, right down there at the bottom? Yeah, perfect. Oh, no, that's great. This is different suture. This is barbed suture. It has little barbs in it. There's several different types. This, especially with complex repairs, like in a myomectomy, you don't have to tie knots anymore. It keeps the tension in the tissue, and especially if you're bringing something together that's wide, it'll just pull it right together, and you don't have to worry about knots. So a lot of GYN surgeons have moved to barbed suture. But you can see the angles that you wouldn't ever be able to obtain with those straight instruments. The other thing is that in the last video, I was operating on one side, and then I relied on an assistant to pull that tissue out. Now, you can, in skinnier patients, lean across the table and operate both sides, or if you put in a second port, you can operate from both. I try to keep ports as minimal as possible, so I would rather struggle with someone across the table than give my patients one more incision. It's probably a little bit dumb. They're so tiny. But in this, I'm coming from the opposite side, but I'm operating both inside the robot. All right, let's show the myomectomy one. Okay, so in this, wait 1 second before you go to it. Oh, sorry. I apologize. So this slide really just shows applications that we can use the robot in GYN surgery. Really, for easy hysterectomies, vaginal should be standard of care, and then basic laparoscopic straight stick surgery after that. Robotic surgery should be for more complex procedures, things that are stuck together, that are very large, uteruses that are above the belly button. For reproductive surgery, we use it for myomectomies, and that's because, again, a baby has to go in that uterus. You want that uterus repaired perfectly, and the robot does provide increased suturing. We use it for endometriosis, and I use it for tubal reversals. So tubal reversals usually is an open incision, and then you bring a microscope over the patient and then put those tiny fallopian tubes back together. Because the robot has high definition 3D vision and micro instruments that I can use, I can do it through small incisions. They're home the same day. They're back to work in 3 days. And the success rates initially, again, this is a newer procedure, have been shown to be exactly the same as open. So it really is a much improved procedure for them. Okay, now we can show the myomectomy video. And this is a sped up video for time, and we might even speed it up, we might even fast forward a little bit more. But you can see the large fibroid here on the back side of the uterus. We're just opening over that now. You can see the angles that I can get with the robotic instruments. That angle you can't get with straight laparoscopy. You have to go at an angle like this. So you could still do the incision part laparoscopically. You can still get fibroids out. You can still suture. I just feel like, having done both ways, I feel like the robotics provides better suturing ability to put the uterus back together when a baby needs to be in there down the road. And then fast forward just a little bit. This is taking, you can see the fibroid there we're taking out. You don't want to see all of that. There you go. Perfect. Enucleating the fibroid right out of the backside of the uterus. She has other little fibroids off that right side as well. And then fast forward a little bit more. See if we can get to the suturing till it's all gone. Yep, keep going. Perfect, yep. So the angles that you can get with this when you have an, and you can make your incision for a myomectomy either up and down or side to side, but the angles that you can get with this are much better than with a straight stick laparoscopy. And then fast forward a little bit more because I think we're almost out of time. We'll just show the end product. So we have time for a few questions. Okay, that's probably good. You can go back to the slide. And that's, again, the barbed suture I talked about before. So the knots aren't needed. Yeah. So for urogynecology, we use it for sacrocolpopexies when mesh goes around the vagina and is pulled up to the back. Different mesh than the mesh kits, which the FDA and lawyers are all up in arms about. Those are, it's different kind of mesh. But again, it's all about suturing. When you're suturing at the sacral promontory, the aorta and iliac vessels are not far. You really need precision. And then in GYN oncology, most GYN oncologists have transitioned to laparoscopic and robotic techniques for their radical hysterectomies and surgical staging of endometrial cancer. Ovarian is still open. It's kind of becoming the new sexy thing. In Vogue in 2006, they put out a piece about robotic surgery. But again, I want to reiterate that robotics is not a replacement for what a surgeon already does well. It's not a replacement for that, and it doesn't make a surgeon better. It's not something that all of a sudden you cannot be that great of a surgeon and with a robot you're fantastic. It is a tool, and it's just a tool in a surgeon's armamentarium that they can perform more complex surgery with. But who knows if down the road that there'll be a robot in every corner and I can be at home in my pajamas operating. I don't think so. Malpractice will never let it go that way. But wouldn't that be awesome? It would be a little bit awesome. I'm still of a control freak. I could never take that away. I like to be, like, in the room. But and then if there's – do we have time for questions? Okay, we don't have time for questions. Sorry. I took too long.
Well, thank you, Dr. Bradshaw. And I'm sure that people will track you down and corner you for their questions.